All right, so beginning in verse 1, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And the Lord sold him in the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he had 900 chariots of iron, and he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lappidoth, was judging Israel at the time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel and the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. And she sent summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you, go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun? And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." And she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went with him. Now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zanim, which is near Kadesh. When Sisera was told that Barak the son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him, from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river of Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword, and not a man was left. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jeul, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jeul came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not be afraid." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say no." But Jeul, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness, so he died. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jeul went out to meet him and said to him, "Come and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in the temple, in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel. And the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. So may the Lord bless his heart, this word to our hearts, and help us to understand it here in a few moments. All right, Father, open our hearts to your word, this amazing story full of information and facts, and help us to see your great deliverance in the big and in the very tiny. We ask this by faith in Christ's name. Amen. You know, the word detail is an interesting word. Detail simply means this: an individual fact or item, as opposed to the whole. An artist is said to pay meticulous attention to detail. You can take your car to get washed, but if you want it to look really good, you want to take it to a detailer. You want them to get out the little toothbrush and scrub where a rag can't get. You want them to go inside the hub and the wheels and get every piece of grease and the seats, the leather seats and everything. You want it detailed down to the most minute points. Details also used for a small detachment of troops. They're not interested in fighting the whole picture or guarding the whole picture. They are detailed one person, a president, a vice president, or whatever it might be. You might read a report at work that covers all of the overall outcome, but if you really want to know what's going on, you want a what? A detailed report. So detailed means very minute, focusing in on one aspect of the whole picture. It's amazing to see the great details of God's amazing rescue. Every detail orchestrated by God, He uses sinners, He uses weaklings, He uses those who fail, He uses people who lead, He uses people who follow Him, He uses nations of any kind to accomplish His deliverance of His people, and even insignificant events that accompany our lives, He is in control of it all. And of course, all of these that we've seen in the book of Judges are all pointing to the main rescuer, Jesus Christ. So let's start by trying to make sense of all of these names that I just read you. And my guess is as we read through that, you might have started getting a little bit confused, and especially all those hard names I had to try to pronounce. So we have a slide here that has all the key characters, and I want to lay that out for you, just so we kind of know who's who. You know, years ago, I don't think they do that anymore, but when I was a kid, if you watched a TV show, they showed the actors in the show. The very beginning, they'd show the picture starring as Barnaby Jones, Buddy Ibsen, and then, you know, all those other people. I don't know why Barnaby Jones came into my head, but it did. So first of all, we have Jabin that was in the story. Jabin is the king in Canaan, very powerful king. And I put an M after that and an F after some of the women because the Bible, sometimes it has like Mary, but in this story, I would have no clue that Jael was a woman. So I put that up there so we could kind of have an idea. It's not like Linda, you know, took a temple and drove it through Frank's head. So it can be a little confusing. So the next character's name is Sisera. That is King Jabin's commander. And he, of course, is a man in this story. And then we have Deborah. Now, she's a female. That one's easy. Deborah. Deborah is now after Ehud. And I thought it was interesting how in verse 1, it says after Ehud. It doesn't mention Shamgar, we talked about last week. Just skipped over him again. So she is the next judge. We have insight into her that she is a follower of God. She knows about God and desires God's glory. So she's a prophetess in Israel, but she's also the next judge. So God picks a female here to deliver His people. The next is Barak. Barak is a male, and he is a military leader in Israel. Now, you have to understand that in the book of Judges, the land of Canaan is a good-sized place, so there might be oppression over here in the north, and maybe not so much oppression in the south. So you don't necessarily have the whole nation under oppression, but here we have Barak, who is a military leader in Israel. Okay, so he's going to join up with Deborah. So now we have a man named Heber. And I don't know if you read this, and we'll get to this. All of a sudden, we came to verse 11, and that verse made no sense whatsoever in the story. Well, we'll get to that. But Heber was in that verse. Heber is a Kenite who decided to move away from his main tribe. They were friendly with Israel, but they also made a treaty with Jabin. Okay, so hold on that thought. Heber's a man. I'd have no idea if Heber was a man or a woman if I didn't know the context of the story. And lastly, we have Jael. Jael is a woman, and she is Heber's wife. So Heber and Jael are married. All right, you got that down pat, right? Well, it'll come back to us as we go. So I wanted to lay that out. This is the key. These are the key characters. All of them have a key part in this amazing story of redemption. All right, so point one. The abuse of undeserved grace. God gives His people undeserved grace to an undeserving people. But once again, God's people abuse it. Did you see that in verse 1? And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after the judge Ehud died. These Israelites couldn't stop doing the same old thing. The pattern of their life consisted of crying out to God when they were in trouble, but walking away from Him when things got good. Let me repeat that. The consistent pattern of their life was calling out to God when they were in trouble and forgetting Him when God rescued them. Guess who's just like that? Every one of us. And they abused the amazing grace that God gave. And they just couldn't do the math. Here's the math. Just as our victory is from God, so our trouble is from God. Because we found out in Judges chapter 2, verses 11 to 15, when they rebelled against God, God raised up an oppressor that came in order to bring them back. So we discover that our way always fails, our way doesn't please God, and God does exactly what He says He will do, and we're in the shape we are in today because it is our fault. Look at verse 2. The Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin. There's Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. So they just kept doing the same thing. And God loved them so much that He brought in an oppressor to grab their attention to bring them back. God will not let His people continue in sin. I was reminded of an incident in my life when I was 18 or 19. And I may have shared this before. I can't remember. I know I've shared it somewhere before. But I worked at a shoe store. And I can't remember if I was even married yet or just right before I was married. I can't remember. But in front of the shoe store in Lawndale, you know where Lawndale is. That used to be the hot place, Washington Square in Lawndale. We had a huge canvas sign that would come down in front of the store. And so during the day, you had this steel little bar that had a round hook on it, and you hooked it on there, and you'd turn it like this. And it would lower the sign during the day. So when the sun was going down, you'd go out there, and you'd hook that on there, and you'd do it the opposite way, and the canvas sign would go right up. So I went out there to do my thing, and I'm out there doing that. Boom, it slipped off of the hook and whacked me right in the head. So I went back and did it again. Boom, it slipped off again, whacked me right in the head. I did it again. Boom, whacked me right in the head. Finally, I got the sign up. I walked back into the shoe store where we had the cash register and everything, and whoever was working there said, "You've got blood streaming down your head." I said, "Oh, I guess the first whack just I wrote it down here. Anyway, the first whack whacked me. And I don't think I was married because my mom came and dad came and took me to the emergency room, and I think you were with them, and took me to the emergency room, and I got stitches on my head. But I kept doing the stupid thing over, boom, over, boom, over. That's exactly what these people did. They kept doing the same thing over and over and over and over, thinking what? This time, it'll work out okay. It's interesting. I thought this was excellent. One author said, quote, "It is difficult to be creative in sin. There's a certain monotony about sin. Most all of it has been done before. It is simply that we do the same thing again. Sin is a boring routine, not a fresh excitement. The fast lane becomes an old rut. Evil never lends itself to originality. Hence, there are two problems: the slavery of sin and the staleness of sin." Now that is outstanding. We're enslaved by sin, but it becomes stale. Now I've never experienced this, but I've heard people say, like with drug abuse, that the first use of it gets them so high, and the second and the third never quite reaches what the first elation was. And so then what do you do? You have to keep doing it again and again and again to try to reach that first high. You know, our society today is full of all kinds of evil, isn't it? Stuff we'd never think we'd ever hear in our world. But you know, there's an amazing truth here. Nothing's new. Nothing our government's doing today is new. You could go into history and you could find them doing it. And everybody, if you're a pre-trib rapture person, you know, you believe 666 is a mark or a sign. I think it's a symbol, and I still love you if you think differently. But Nations have done that before. Nations have marked people. Nations have tried that. There is really nothing new. Satan doesn't come up with anything new. Satan simply rehashes the old in a little bit twisting way of what he used to do. And that's the nature of sin. There is simply nothing new about sin other than the fact that it grabs people and it's really stale. It never gives what it promises. It always leaves people empty. But instead of turning to Christ, they turn away. And isn't it something that we see this pattern? As long as the judge was there, they followed God. But as soon as he died, what happened? They went back to their old ways. Have you ever worked with somebody who slacked off and hardly did anything? Lazy, cut corners, lied. But all of a sudden, when the boss is walking down the hall, what happens to them? They turn into this amazing employee of the month. And you're looking at them going, that's unbelievable. But guess what? That's exactly what we do with God, isn't it? It's exactly what we do, the same thing. And sadly, that's the definition of many people's religions. Someone said, there must be a genuine, real, internal work of God. Not just, oh, the pastor's there, I have to act this way. Oh, I'm in the church building, I've got to act this way. Have you ever heard somebody say, if I walked into that church building, the ceiling would cave in? Well, guess what? There's no magical, all of a sudden, God sees us when we walk in here. What a sad thing that our religion many times is simply external only because somebody on earth is watching us. Didn't Jesus say that in Mark 6, 7, 6, and 7? Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. He said in Matthew 6, beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. So once again, they have abused God's grace, so they're in a mess. It's just math. 1 + 1 = 2. We abuse God's grace, we get into a mess. Secondly, we see in this passage the source of undeserved grace. What is the source? Where does this undeserved grace come from? Well, look at verses 6 and 7. Verses 6 and 7. So she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, the Kedesh Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? God is the source. She brings up, God is the source. Go gather your men. So apparently, maybe God had already told this guy this, and maybe he was hem-hawing around, don't know for sure. But it's awesome. Look at verse 7. God says, I will draw out Sisera, the commander of Jabin, to meet you by this river. He will bring his chariots, he will bring his troops, and I will give him into your hand. So isn't it awesome that she says, this is a work of God? Unlike some of the other judges who were not sure if they even knew God, at least Shamgar. But isn't it something that God is using people here? Look at verse 9, you see the work of God again, the source. She said, Barak said, I'm not going to go to the battle if you don't go with me. She said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory. You're not going to be the general who brings the victory. The Lord's going to sell this commander Sisera into the hand of a woman. Now, that's a little bit different than in our day. I mean, that's like the total disgrace back then. A woman's going to defeat you. And Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. So she gives God the glory again. God is going to hand over this enemy that's suppressing us, using people. 14 through 16, once again, God is the source. Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Doesn't the Lord go out before you? So Barak went down from Tabor with 10,000 of his men following. And who routed Sisera in verse 15? The Lord. The Lord routed Sisera and all his army before Barak. So here you have three cases. I left out 16. Barak pursued the chariots from his army with his army to Harosheth Hagoyim, and the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. Who did that? God did it. And so she is highlighting for us this great source of what we do not deserve. It is God giving it to you, God giving it to you, God providing, God defeating the enemy, even though you don't deserve it. And it's kind of refreshing to see one of these judges give God the glory. I mean, how many times do we get delivered? Does God provide for us and we fail to give him the glory and thank him for it? So it's kind of refreshing to see. But I want you to go back to verse 11. Now, this is interesting. We're reading this amazing story of generals and kings and commanders and armies and iron chariots. I mean, we are glued to the screen. And all of a sudden in verse 11, now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zaninim, which is near Kadesh. And the next verse simply says, when Sisera was told that Barak the son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor, he called his chariots 900 chariots of fire. Now what if I said to you this story? I was driving to church today. I put my trumpet in my case into the car, and I sat down and I turned on the Christmas channel, and I was driving on Oak Hill, and I looked down in the passenger side floorboard, and there was a snake, a thick, it looked like a rattlesnake, it had that same color, and I saw it coiled up on the passenger seat of the car. And I am driving thinking, what in the world am I going to do? And then I saw it move, and then it kind of slithered over onto my side and got on my shoe. And I am sweating and I am scared to death. And what do I do? Do I stop? Do I jump out of my car? Do I hope it goes back over there? Who put the snake there anyway? I locked the door. I mean, so I'm driving along and all of a sudden the snake begins to crawl up my right leg. And he curls around my right leg and he makes his way and he's like right here. And by the way, my uncle painted his house green yesterday. And then the snake was just, see what I did there? What does my uncle painting his house green have to do anything with the snake story? Isn't that what he did here? We got chariots and we got army generals and we got kings and we got this prophetess and we got 10,000 men. And by the way, my uncle painted his house green yesterday. And then I can't believe the snake went up around my neck. And it's like, what's verse 11 got to do with anything? Well, it has a lot. We have a new character mentioned, don't we? Now, Heber the Kenite, and the Kenites were descendants of Moses' father-in-law. They were obviously allies of Israel, but they also had made a treaty with the king of Jabin. When I hold that thought, we'll come back to it. I love it. So, it's amazing to see what's going on here. And we're going to come back to that, because I think it's one of the key things, the neat things of this passage. Here are some facts of the battle. How God brought the victory. What was going on here to a troubled people? Isn't it something that God is going to bring out this powerful army? God is going to bring out this powerful army. He raised up King Jabin. And Jabin has chariots of iron. Now, picture 900 chariots with horses pulling them. I assume one horse is pulling one chariot. Now, anybody been to a NASCAR race? I went to watch practice once at the Brickyard in Indy. And I was so disappointed because everybody who's been to a race said, you're not going to believe it when 43 cars pass you at the same time. You are just, the stand shake, your heart will beat. It's just unbelievable. Well, they didn't pass each other. They all kind of just practiced. I was a little bit disappointed. But I do remember when one car would go by, you'd feel it in your heart. And it was, can you imagine all of these chariots and horses? Now, I got out my calculator. That's 3,600 horse legs, because each horse has four legs. I can't imagine a horse with three legs being in this army, so we're going with the four legs. I mean, that's four legs. You know what horses sound like? On the beaten path, that's 1,800 chariot wheels turning across the ground. That's pretty terrifying to me, right? I mean, it's like in our day. If you were over in Iraq and all of a sudden you saw 35 F-16s flying over you, or F-18s, or A-10 Warthogs, the tank killers. I mean, just can you imagine that? So this is a scary thing. Who brought them? God brought them. You see, God will do whatever it takes to bring us back. However many chariots, however many horses. Then he promised in this text, you will be victorious, but not in the way you think. A woman's going to take down Sisera. Now, isn't that something? You know, God brings victory if we follow him, but not always in the way we think. Who would have thought that God would have sent his son, the king, the creator, to take on a form of a man and to die the way he did when he had the power to send 10,000 angels? And in our lives, God brings victory many times in a way we never dream. Interesting, what else is going on in this passage is God chooses people. We're going to see that next week, because in the song she writes, she's going to mention people who refuse to help. God uses people. God used 10,000 soldiers. And most time, all in Scripture, God uses people to give his undeserved grace. And I love verse 14 where God says, I'm with you. Up! For this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Doesn't the Lord go out before you? That's a great truth. In this account, we have the promise that God is there with us. And not just with us, but out in front of us. So tomorrow when you go into your hard place of work and a difficult situation, Jesus is right there. He's already been there. Or when you go to the doctor and you go to the clinic or you go to see the results or you're facing a difficult situation, isn't it awesome to know that the Lord has already been there and the Lord has not abandoned you? He's the source of undeserving grace. And we're going to see in next week's song that she wrote that God sent a rainstorm to help defeat these chariots of iron. Well, you just can't wait to be here next week, can you? Isn't that cool? What an amazing detailed plan, which leads to the next point. The details of undeserved grace. The details. Suddenly, verse 11 comes back into play. Again, verse 11 is that weird verse that makes no sense. We got a snake crawling up my shoulder. Oh, by the way, Target's got peppermint on sale. You know, it just doesn't make sense. So what is this verse here for? Well, verse 11 tells this man Heber, who was a Kenite, who was an ally of Israel, for whatever reason decides he's going to take his ball and leave. Taking my ball, and I'm going home. He packs up. He pulls up stakes. He moves far away from the main clan of Kenites. Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zaananim, which is near Kadesh. So he just grabs his folks, his family, and his tent, and he just heads off. Well, what in the world does this have to do with God saving his people and giving undeserved grace? Is this just a ho-hum big deal? You know, kind of like our lives, get up, go to work, come home, eat food, do something, go to bed, get up. Just mundane, boring, every day, guy got up and moved. Or is this God's detailed working out his amazing grace? How many times do supposedly random things occur in your life and mine, and we don't recognize a detailed God moving on our behalf, even hard things? I mean, this is just routine. Certainly God isn't in this. This is very insignificant. Maybe God just isn't that involved in my life anywhere. Because you know what I've discovered most every day is pretty much just routine, isn't it? It is. It's just routine. It's just the everyday mundane things of life. This guy gets up and he decides to move away from his people. Big deal. Move on. I want to know where the snake is. Did the snake bite you in the neck? Did you crash? Did you do like they do on TV and grab it on the head? Because I've seen that on TV, right? That's what I would have tried. No, I think I probably would have been crying. I'm not really sure what I would have done. We also know, look at the end of verse 17. There was peace between Jabin, that's the king of Canaan, Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. So not only were they allies with Israel, they had also made a treaty with this king of Canaan, which they should not have done. Therefore, if our commander Sisera, who we read got on foot and ran away because his army was being routed, came to somebody in the house of this Kenite, he might feel pretty safe, right? I'm running for my life. My army has been routed. My goodness, I come to a place who is an ally, Heber the Kenite. Well, that's exactly what happened, wasn't it? Verse 17. So Barak is pursuing the chariots. Sisera, verse 17, fled away on foot to the tent of Jeul, the wife of Heber, or verse 11, Heber the Kenite, because there was peace there. So Sisera thinks he is good. I'm in an ally's house. I'm going to be safe. Now, who did Sisera run into? Jeul, the wife of this Kenite. Apparently, husband Kenite, Heber, was gone. Apparently, he was out, washing his donkey or something. I'm not really sure what he was doing. So it was kind of odd for a man to walk into her tent. But why did he just happen to show up at her tent? Why not all the other tents in the area? Is God in charge of the small details? Sure is. Now, let's read on here. Verse 18, Jeul, the wife of verse 11, Heber, came out to meet this Sisera, the commanding general, and said, hey, baby. See, I kind of think maybe she lured him in. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't say that, but I think so. Hey, baby. I lost my place after that baby. Turn aside, my Lord. Turn aside to me and don't be afraid. So he turned aside to her into the tent and she covered him with a rug. I can't help it, but I picture a big white polar bear rug. isn't that what's always in the movies, a big bear rug? And so for whatever reason, get under the rug. I'll cover you with the rug, baby. So she does that, verse 18. Well, now he's been running, so he's thirsty. And he said to her, please give me a little water to drink. I'm thirsty. Now, we don't have any idea why she did this, but she opened up a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. Now, some scholars said that maybe the milk was to soothe him a little bit. You know, I like drinking a glass of milk before I go to bed. I don't know why. A cold glass of milk, I just let it go. It's got protein in it, you know. It's nice and it's just cool and cold. And I don't know if it relaxes me, but anyway, she doesn't give him water. She gives him milk. You know, my crazy brain thinks that maybe she slipped him a Mickey. I don't even know what that is. I just see it on the movies. Put a little medicine in there or whatever. We don't know, but he does kind of, you know, fall asleep. So then in verse 20, he's still a little concerned because it's odd for a man to walk into her tent. And he said to Jeul, you stand at the opening of the tent. And if any man comes and asks you, hey, who came in that tent? You got a man in there? Is anyone here? You say no. So that's, he wants to take a nap. He's been running. He's got the nice, cold, Prairie Farms milk inside of him. He's under this wonderful bear rug or donkey rug or camel rug, whatever they had back then, or wool, whatever they made. That'd be itchy. You stand at the door, and somebody's surely probably going to come and say, hey, Jeul, who you got in there? You just tell them, ain't nobody here. Go on your way. So that's the plan. Well, verse 21. Apparently, he falls asleep, He's running. He's tired. He's got that glass of milk. Jeul, the wife of Heber, the mysterious verse 11, took a tent peg. You see, when you put a tent, you always want one extra peg. OK, case a vampire comes or something, you always want an extra peg. Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg, and she had a hammer. Because, you know, apparently they just put up the tent. You know, they moved away, that verse 11, weird verse 11. Maybe it was there, and that's her plan. And she went softly to him. If you are going to drive a tent peg in a man's temple, you want to walk softly, all right? You've heard the phrase, walk softly and carry a big stick. Is that correct? Okay, everything comes from the Bible. And drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground. And he was lying fast asleep from weariness. And I love how the Bible just says, so he died. Come on! Give me some details here, you know? Did he, oh, no, stop, you know? No, so he died. Isn't that amazing? Let me ask you a question. How did she, the wife of Heber, Jael, end up in this spot? Now, all of a sudden, verse 11 makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Why did the author of Judges this all of a sudden, oh, I better throw this in here in verse, well, they didn't have verses, but I better throw this in right here. Now it makes perfectly good sense because God was in the details and he moved this family to the place where the commander was going to be so he could deliver his people through a woman who was a good hammerer of a tent peg. And to the ground. But notice verse 22. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him. I think she's probably pretty proud of herself. And said to him, I don't think she said, hey, baby, this time, but hey, come and I will show you the man whom you're looking for. Got him in my tent. He ain't going anywhere. A, he's pegged to the ground, and B, he's dead. Kind of a waste of a glass of milk, isn't it? I think that probably soothed him more. So he went into her tent. 10,000 army. He's the leader of 10,000 soldiers. I mean, that's a man's man right there. I probably would be given in charge of the latrine crew. You know, Tim, you take care of the guys cleaning the toilets. Yes, sir. I mean, 10,000's a lot of people that will listen to your every word. And he's hunting for this guy. He's being brave. He's being courageous. He's doing what God said. Hey, Barak, come here. So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. Now, isn't that amazing? And who got the glory? So on that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel. And the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. Now, isn't that an amazing thing? And I find that part of verse 11 and God getting there the most fascinating part of this whole story. How God moved in the details. So just a couple of quick applications here. You know that nothing is ever forgotten or left out in our redemption plan. There's no power greater than God. Nothing can defeat his plan. Not you, not us. I remember taking my car once to get an oil change. I think I had like a $5 gift card. It was $5 for a whole oil change back in 1756. It was when it was $5. And I remember checking my oil, and some of it had clean oil, and some of it was as dark and dirty as can be. And I drove back, and I looked under the hood, and they hadn't changed the oil filter. So I took it back and said, hey, your guys forgot to change the oil filter. Oh, okay. Little detail missing there. My brother took me up to his office once, now that was in the building that went down last Sunday. That was his office on the 10th floor. And he showed me a computer program that shows structural buildings, an $80,000 computer program, and it shows every nut and every bolt and every detail about every nut and every bolt and the torque and all of that, and that was just one screen. So when you look at a building, do you go, man, I wonder how many bolts and nuts are in that building? Or do you go, wow, that's an amazing building? You look at the whole, don't you? But he had to look at every detail so that the integrity of the structure would be intact. Same thing, God. God never misses a detail. Have you ever received a gift and when you opened it or you bought something and there was something missing? All the time. Do you know what they put in boxes now? They actually put in there, because they know somebody's not gonna mess up and not put a bolt or a nut. It actually says, do not call the store or take back to the store. Call this number. The next time you buy something you got to put together, there'll be a little card in there. Do not take it back to the store. Do not call the store. You know, God never leaves us a sign in our salvation and our redemption. If I forget something, here's the number, call the store. Never. He's very detailed. So we have the first one on the screen. God has power through Christ to defeat the most powerful enemy in our lives, and that's sin, and that's through the cross. He left out nothing. Secondly, God has the power through Christ to defeat a sin that you are struggling in. Those sins like the Israelites did over and over. There's no sin in your life that's greater than the power of Christ. As sin is mundane, sin is old, sin never comes through with what it promises. The cross saves us, and the cross continues to teach us to die to self and to live for God and to give Him the glory. Thirdly, God has the power through Christ to save you completely and has left nothing out in your deliverance. There's no detail missing. You are 100% forgiven, 100% justified. You are kept secure 100%. You are His child. That will never, ever end if you've truly been born from above. The writer of Hebrews put it this way: consequently, He is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through Him, since He always lives to make intercession for them. Nothing's been missed. You don't have to worry that you're going to get to heaven and God look at you and go, I think I made a mistake with this one. Whoops, I forgot to justify them. I forgave them, but I forgot to give them Jesus, right? There's nothing forgotten. And lastly, God has the power and is sovereign over every detail of your life. Even the details that seem so minute and so unimportant, just like verse 11, about His will for our lives. God has the power. He showed us this, and everything that comes into your life is there to be a part of your being delivered even today. God has power over the insignificant. What a wonderful truth. So what's our call? Stay faithful. Place our trust in His detailed salvation, His detailed control in our life, and make sure that our religion is not just external and outward, and I don't want somebody else seeing me do this, but I'm living for my God, the source of my detailed redemption. Father, thank You for this amazing story, and it's amazing how what seems out of place was really Your redemptive plan. And help us to realize that it's very out of place for God to die, but that was Your plan for our eternal salvation. And Lord, as we live our life for You, trusting You for so many things, we're thankful that You're in every detail. There's no accidents. Who we're married to, who our children are, who our family is, where we live, the job we have, our health, every single situation is a part of Your minute working, Your glory through us. And help us to be willing servants, as we'll see in the song next week. So work in our hearts, Lord, give us a thankful heart of Your detailed salvation for us. We pray by faith in Christ's name. Amen.